Hi, I'm Kyone Wolf, in for Colin McEnroe. Today I'm going to introduce you to some Connecticut residents who have careers in very different fields of expertise. Later in the show, you'll meet Larry Elsner, who's been driving limos for 40 years. He'll tell us a few stories about driving famous people and dead people and what makes him different than any other driver. You'll also hear from Bishop John Selders, who serves in the United Church of Christ, and he's the co-founder of Moral Monday, Connecticut. He'll talk about how he gets treated differently when he wears the collar and about his fear and faith in this increasingly chaotic world. But first, let's meet Marilyn Nelson. She was the Poet Laureate of Connecticut between 2001 and 2006. She's the Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, and she's the Poet in Residence of the Poets' Corner at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. She's the author of many books of poetry, including A Wreath for Emmett Till, and most recently a book for teens, American Ace. We recorded this conversation in her home, and I started off by asking her about the earliest poem she ever wrote.
I don't remember my first poem, but I do remember an early one that I wrote when I was in sixth grade, I believe, about my baby brother. And I can probably recite it. I think I know it. His name was Melvin. He's 10 years younger than I. He was 10 years younger than I. And this was, "Little Sir Melvin, in knighthood is he, rides on a black charger. It's really my knee. His sword is a bottle, his armor a gown, and he looks quite splendid as he rides through our town."
Yay! Now, how do you know? You've written a lot of poems in your life. How do you know when you're done with a poem?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. There is a great sense of satisfaction that comes over you, though, when you have that feeling, oh, yes. And then if you set it aside and look at it again, sometimes 15 minutes later, you realize it's completely wrong. You have to do the whole thing over again. Some poet said that the way you know a poem is finished is that you can't stand to read it again. It's really frustrating to keep discovering that there are always things you can tinker with.
The book A Wreath for Emmett Till, the form, you used iambic pentameter and a heroic crown of sonnets. Can you explain what that is and why you chose to use it?
Crown of sonnets is a sequence of sonnets in which the last line of one sonnet becomes the first line of the next one. A normal crown of sonnets has the first line of the first sonnet being also the last line of the last sonnet. So that's a crown of sonnets. A heroic crown of sonnets is a sequence of 15 sonnets that work in that way. And the last one, number 15, a sonnet has 14 lines. And the last sonnet in a heroic crown of sonnets is made up of the last lines of the first 14 sonnets. And it's the Dickens to write. I can't imagine anybody wanting to write a second heroic crown of sonnets. Yeah.
I have so many questions about this book. I read the description of what you were doing, but I don't think I really wrapped my head around what it would feel like to read it. Mm. And then at the end, to see all those lines stacked on each other, to have a final say, was really powerful. I want to ask you why you wanted to write this book, but at the same time, why wouldn't you want to write this book? But why did you write this book?
An editor called my agent and said she had an idea for a book which she thought only I could write. And she asked us to come into her office so she could discuss it with us. She wouldn't say what it was over the phone. So my agent and I went to her office and sat down, and she closed the door and said, "I've always wanted to publish a book for children about lynching." And I just pretty much fell off my chair. And we had a long conversation about it, and I told her I would try. Otherwise, I would never have taken this up. So it was a tremendous challenge.
Were you confident you could take it on? Or were you just going to give it your best shot? No.
Good God, no. I just gave it my best shot. Yes, that's all you can ever do. But I mean, I was really terribly daunted by the idea. And at first I was struggling. I mean, we had a conversation about it. Maybe there could be a boy in his backyard and there's a tree in the yard that's haunted. And how do you write a book about lynching for children? How do you do that? And finally, this wonderful editor said, just write what you want to write. Just write it. Don't think about the audience. Just write the poem that you're called to write. And that freed me and freed my imagination. And, well, the experience of writing it was really awesome.
What did that experience do to you?
It made me cry a lot. The first thing I did was I went to the public library and looked at this book of postcards of lynchings, photographs of lynchings, and it was, I couldn't even get through 10 pages of it. And my heart couldn't bear doing research about this. And so I decided to write about Emmett Till because he was a child and he was the age that I imagined I was writing for. It was really awesome. It was really, especially toward the end of it, because I wrote the end of it in a blaze of sleeplessness. I just wrote and wrote and wrote for several days because after a while I didn't know what was coming next in the poem, because so much of the creation of a poem in this really tight form is working together with the form. The form itself leads you to say things you didn't know you were going to say. So I didn't know where it was going. And I just was fascinated watching it unfurl, kind of under my control, but not completely under my control. It was a wonderful experience.
Was there anybody who lit you up in terms of being confident about your ability to write poetry? Or was it all you? You knew what you were doing. You knew that this was your path in life. Which was it?
I was a really sensitive child, a crybaby. And my mother's friends would always look at her with her eyebrows raised when I cried over a beautiful sunset or beautiful rose bush. And my mother would always put her arm around my shoulders and say, no, no, don't worry, Marilyn's okay. She's very sensitive. She's our poet. And so I think that probably started before I had any inkling of what I wanted to do. So that was the beginning of it. And then I had a sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Gray, who on the last day of school went around the class and told everyone what she expected us to be when we grew up. And for me, she said, you'll be a poet. And so those were the earliest seriously encouraging notes of my early life, I guess.
What poets are blowing your mind right now?
Let's see, I heard Tayemba Jess read recently. He won the Pulitzer Prize this year for a book called Olio, O-L-I-O. At this reading, he read something I'd heard him read once before. He calls it syncopated sonnets. It's five sonnets about a set of conjoined twins who were born in slavery and became world famous performers. They spoke five languages. Tayemba's sonnets can be read, five sonnets. They can be read from line 1 to line 14, or they can be read from line 14 to line 1, and they make sense either way. All of them work that way. Or you can read across, he puts them in the shape of a star. You can read line 1 of the first one, continue to line 1 of the second one, and then go to line 2 of the first one, and line 2 of the second one, and so on, and they make sense that way. Or you can read them backwards from line 14, and you can read them sideways. It's mind-blowing. It is so mind-boggling, and both times I've heard them read, the entire audience is gasping. This book is unlike anything that's ever been done before.
Going back to Emmett Till, is there any subject that comes to mind that you would not be interested in covering?
Oh, well, I'm not interested in writing about bad people, anger, or expressing anger. I would not write another poem about lynching, for example. I don't want to write poems about outrage. I have been writing during this last few months, but what I've been writing is, I think, not exactly a direct expression of outrage, but I don't know, catches voices. A couple of poems are in the voices of Syrian refugees, for example. And they're more sad than expressions of outrage. Or I have a poem about the way the depredations the human race is making on the planet and on the other intelligent animals on the planet. But again, it's a description of those things. It's more sad than an expression of outrage.
If sadness is part of what you can be drawn to or you're comfortable working within, it's tempting to think about hope, especially in times where it feels hopeless. Is writing about hope a cliche?
Oh, well, everything that's true can be boiled down to a cliche. Truth, with everything that we call a truism, is also truth. I think that it's hard to survive without hope. One of the things our poets can do for us is to remind us that humans are really bad, frankly. Humans are kind of monstrous. And yet, every time you say that, you also have to recognize that there is a ballet dancer who's in the subway stop when somebody pushes a man onto the tracks and he jumps down, he leaps down. He does a tour jeté down to the tracks and lifts this unconscious man up and then kind of leaps back onto the platform after saving this man's life. This happens. We are capable of that. Even though in some ways we are not worth saving, in some ways we are. We have to look for the possibilities, not condemn. This is the Old Testament story in which the Lord is getting ready to destroy a city, and the human being who maybe Abraham says, yeah, but what if there are 100 just men in the city? And God says, well, if there are 100 just men, I'll spare the city. And then Abraham says, well, what if there are 20 just men? And God says, well, if there are 20 just men, I'll save the city. And Abraham says, well, what if there are 10? And finally, they have it worked out that if there's one just man in the city is worth saving. And we have to say the same thing, I think.
That's the role of the poet?
It's a possible role of a poet. It's, you know, if this is your task, if you're willing to accept it. There are other things poets can do, but I think this is one of the most valuable things we can do, is to show, I don't know, it's what art does, to show the best potential of humanity.
That was Marilyn Nelson, Poet Laureate of Connecticut between 2001 and 2006, Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, and Poet in Residence of the Poets' Corner at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. We'll go out of this segment with an excerpt of her reading A Wreath for Emmett Till at Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C. Audio is courtesy of C-SPAN. This is the final sonnet in the book, The Crown of Sonnets, she was talking about earlier, the collection of first lines from each previous sonnet into this final sonnet.
Rosemary for remembrance, Shakespeare wrote. If I could forget, believe me, I would. Pierced by the screams of a shortened childhood, Emmett Till's name still catches in my throat. Mamie's one child, a body thrown to bloat, mutilated boy martyr. If I could erase the memory of Emmett's victimhood, the memory of monsters, that bleak thought tears through the patchwork drapery of dreams. Let me gather spring flowers for a wreath. Trillium, apple blossoms, Queen Anne's lace, Indian pipe, bloodroot, white as moonbeams, like the full moon which smiled calmly on his death, like his gouged eye which watched boots kick his face.
Thank you, Marilyn Nelson. We'll be back after a short break with a conversation with limo driver Larry Elsner. We'll talk about his adventures being on the road for 40 years. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Kyone Wolf in for Colin McEnroe. Today we're talking with three very different Connecticut residents who have careers in very different fields of expertise. Joining us now is Larry Elsner. He's the owner-operator of Solico Driving Services. Larry's been a limo driver for 40 years. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so a lot can happen behind the wheel over 40 years. What is a memorable drive that you've given?
Well, when I started off in the business 40 years ago, I started off as a newbie. So you go to work for these contract companies, and you get all the bad jobs. You get the weddings, you get the funerals, you get the local airport jobs, you get a lot of little short jobs to prove yourself. Huh. And then once I got into the business, then what happened is people start calling, hey, Larry, can you drive for me? Larry, can you do this? So I was always willing to help anybody in the business I could. So I know when you did the intro, you made reference to the story about the hearse. So I want to address that first.
Yeah, we'd like to start off with hearses.
Hearse story is a great story.
So
what happened was a funeral home in Hartford apparently had someone that didn't show up for work. So I got a call. Hey, Larry, we have a funeral in like 2 hours. Can you come? Can you drive our hearse? Okay, fine. What do I know? Put the thing in drive, they load the box up, they close it. Well, but a lot of people don't realize there's a lot of moving parts when these things happen. So what had happened basically was they put the coffin in the back of this probably 1974 hearse. It's a big old thing. They loaded it with flowers. They loaded it with everything. Mm-hmm. What they didn't do, they didn't put what they call the stopper behind the hearse, behind the coffin. So they closed the door and they said, Larry, all you have to do is drive. I said, okay, great.
Follow
the guy in front of you. So I did. So we're driving down Hartford. We go through the streets. We get to Cedar Hill Cemetery. Back then, it was they didn't pave the roads. They had ruts and they had all kinds of crazy stuff. So I follow the lead car, and as I'm going, the lead car's getting up ahead of me, and I hit a pothole.
Ugh.
And because the coffin was not secured in the back, I heard the thing go, and it's on a roller, and I heard this bang. The next thing you know, I see the door fly open in the mirror, the family car is behind it, the box comes out, and it lands kind of like on an angle. I didn't know what to do. Scared the bejesus out of me. So I figured, all right, well, the only thing you can do is put it back in the car. So I go back. I apologize to the family. It was funny because the pallbearers, I kind of made the motion of, you know, come help me. The pallbearers got out of the car. We picked the coffin up. We put it back in, and we put the little stopper in, and we continued. So the good thing that came out of it being a driver, you get paid to be a driver. You also get paid for being a pallbearer. So that day, the plus to the whole story was not only did I get paid for being the driver, I got being paid for being a pallbearer, and I always come up with the term now, I that day was one of the last ones to let you down.
That is enormously disturbing.
Oh, it is thank disturbing. You. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. So, yeah. But back up for a second, though, because you could have gone into stand-up comedy, but you went into being a driver. Why?
I think my dad, God bless him, and my mom, and dad was in retail for over 40 years locally, and he always said to me, Larry, look, I don't care what you do, but what you do, do it well. So I tend to interact with people well. I think I'm a good driver. I like to help people. My main job is to get them from point A to point B safely. So I decided to go into the limousine business.
So you were mentioning that weddings are not really a good job. Why do you say that?
Well, because it's everybody's partying all the time, and you always run into conflicts, you know.
Huh.
You pull up, and you got 18 bridesmaids, and you got 18 groomsmen. So you have the brides, and you have the grooms. And then it's coordination. And photographers, they tend to just take over the show, mm-hmm. you know. And I tell people, you know, well, what color car do you want? Do you want a white one or a black one? Well, if we went white, I said, well, you're wearing a white dress. So if you stand there for pictures, the color's going to wash out in the car.
That's an important detail.
Yeah, they said that's a great idea. So, you know, people sometimes listen to me for the experience that I have, you know. Celebrities, it was a great job for the younger people. When I was young, now I'm talking, I'm 62. And so going back, I was in my late 20s, early 30s. So you get this gig from the Greater Hartford Open years ago. Actually, it was the Sammy Davis Jr. Greater Hartford Open. And I was selected, I don't know why, probably by default, got the short straw to drive Sammy Davis Jr. around. So back then, we had a police car, a lead car, and two motorcycle cops. So we would drive all the way, you know, go to Wethersfield Country Club. So we're sitting at the golf tournament, and people do crazy things. You know, I don't know what it is. When people see a limousine, right away they think it's theirs, you know. So people are curious too because the windows are all dark. So a lady comes up and there's a cop standing next to me, and she says, "Who's in the car? Oh, what a beautiful car! Who's in the car?" I said, "Millionaire industrialist Larry Elsner." Oh, I know that name. Oh, I think I know him. I've seen him on TV. So people just don't get it, you know. Night outs, when we do night outs, same thing. You know, you pull up in front of a bar, your people are drinking, and everybody else in town is drinking also, and you always get the person that says, oh, hey, there's my car. I said, well, if it was your car, let me look at the registration. Maybe it is your car. I said, but now it's my car. So, you know, it's just people do crazy things when they see limousines.
Now, who are the clients that you typically take around now, lately?
Now I do 90% of my stuff is corporate.
So where do you take them?
I take them usually New York, Boston, sometimes Philly.
Yeah.
We do New Haven train station, Bradley Airport.
So that's the most common.
Yeah. And they're steady. That's what I love now in my career is the steadiness of working with the corporate people. Yeah. They're wonderful.
Now, I imagine some corporate people are like, you know, you do your job, I'm going to sit in back and work on this. Are a lot of them like that, or is there some sort of interaction that keeps happening with you guys?
I think the interaction comes from me knowing all their idiosyncrasies.
Hmm.
So I know if I get to pick up a guy at 4:45 in the morning and he has to go to New York City, he's not going to be too talkative because a lot of my executives are very intense. So they want to just get in the car, get on their BlackBerry or BlueBerry or the Dingleberry or whatever they're on. And I drive the car. That's all. My job is to drive and to get you there.
Yeah.
But the beauty part about the corporate people is since you have them all the time, I know that, for example, Mr. Jones likes coffee black from Dunkin' Donuts. Sorry for the plug. so I will make every effort to have a black cup of coffee and Dunkin' Donuts. And a lot of the drivers don't go further than driving the car. So I think that's what separates me from like a contract driver. I mean, I drove for the limousine companies, and you have this don't care attitude, like, okay, oh, I got to take this schlub to a ball game, and I got to sit there, and oh my God, what am I going to do? And you know, when you're an owner operator like I am, you know, you tend to be more attentive to the client's needs. Mm-hmm. And you know, honestly, Kion, anybody can drive a car, but you have to drive it well.
See, that brings me to my next question. you know, there's, of course, Uber and Lyft, and they're super popular now. How have you fared, pun intended, against Uber and Lyft?
It's funny because I was down in Florida recently and with my wife, and I used Uber, and I never thought in the world of, you know, limousine business I would ever use Uber. The only thing that I see with Uber is a lot of them do this part-time. Their cars are very small. They're very nice people, don't get me wrong, but a lot of them, like in Florida, they don't speak English. So I say, I'm going to go over to downtown Disney. So they say, okay, and they grunt and they groan and they get in the car. And off we go for the half fares. I had a couple days ago, I was in Boston with a group, and I took an Uber, and I told the guy I was going to Brookline, and I gave him the address. So he took me to Brookline Avenue in downtown Boston. So you know, the people, I do all my research ahead of time where I'm going. I got to go, I have to know where I'm going. And the Uber guys, they just, it's a part-time thing. Some do it just because they're retired, they want to get out of the house. Some do it just because they just like to drive.
Now, we've got just a couple minutes left. When I know time's flying.
Oh my.
So since you're a driver, that means you're in traffic a lot. Do you have any advice for people in terms of coping mentally and physically with traffic?
I think you just have to sit there, and I grit my teeth a lot. I have dental issues because I grind the heck out of my teeth. It's just, this is what you're paid to do. So you have to have a presence of mind. You're not going to stop the traffic. You're not going to stop, you know, what's happening there. You just go and do your research. Go the best route you think you know, and it's always going to happen because there's so much construction in the state of Connecticut, and it's in New York. I was down there last night. The UN is in session. Can you imagine the turmoil and the chaos between First Avenue and Fourth Avenue, and everything's barricaded, and you can't take right turns, you can't take left turns?
So maybe like some deep breathing and a mouth guard?
Yeah,
that what you're
absolutely.
Saying?
And then maybe a little something to drink, which I can't say that, a little taste. But no, I don't drink and drive. I pull over. Okay, go ahead.
Larry, if you were going to go back to yourself 40 years ago, first of all, would young Larry 40 years ago be surprised that he's still doing this? And what advice would you give him?
Oh boy, I've always been in the service business, and I've enjoyed my time. And would I do this again? Yes. Would I learn about the business? Yes. Would I own my own business? Yes. Because as you learn, you grow and you advance in knowledge. And so now I know all the mistakes I made over 40 years, and I'm fairly successful. I don't solicit new clients. You know, people tend to find me. But the other thing with that, honestly, is. Sometimes when you tell them the price, you know, family especially, they said, you know, I want to go to the casino. I told my mother this one day, God bless her. She says, I want to take myself and two of the girls and get down to the casino. I said, okay, Matt, $50 an hour plus tip. She goes, I'm your mother. I said, I'm a for-profit agency. You know, so this is just the way it is. Everybody wants something for nothing. You know, this is why I don't advertise. I don't want the 3 o'clock in the morning calls of, hey, I'm drunk. I'm at Freddy's Bar. Can you take me home? Right. Leave that to the Uber and Lyft guys.
Now, I'm wondering, you're sitting in a car all day, and you're a big dude, and you don't get to move much. So
correct.
How does this job affect your health?
It's terrible. I'm diabetic. I'm overweight, but I'm funny overweight. You know, fat people are usually happy. It has affected my health. What I do now is if I'm on a waiting job, when I'm sitting there, I will lock the car and I'll walk. And I bring a pair of sneakers. And, you know, if I'm long day, I'll bring a pair of shorts and I walk around.
What do you do? Because you do a lot of waiting and sometimes you're waiting for your client to come back. What do you typically do when you're waiting?
Word trek.
What?
Word trek on the
word
computer.
Trek?
A little
is that
word
a game?
Trek. Yeah, it's a game. It's
you
or,
young
or,
people
yeah,
in your
I
games,
know. I had to get into it at 62 because I had no idea what it was or buzzword or whatever these things are. So, yeah, I do a lot on the – and then I'm booking work and I'm, you know, eating. I love eating. Oh, my God, you can tell by the size of me. Does this shirt make me look fat? No, I told my wife I was looking to say that.
You got it out. Is there anything that people get really wrong? Like when they think about – when you say you're a driver, what do they get wrong? What are they not getting right?
The – that there's more to it than just driving. It's not just a driver. You've got to apply yourself. You've got to. People think that, as a driver, you're just a driver. But there's more to it. You have to take the extra step. There's drivers and there's drivers. There's real drivers or chauffeurs or whatever you call them. Yeah. The contract guys, it's like, oh, I got another job. I got to go to the airport. And the company's not paying me a lot of money and I just don't care. I think if you want to get in this business, you have to care more than the paycheck. You have to care about the people. You have to care about your vehicle. Some guys show up with cars, they're just trash.
What kind of car are you driving now?
I have a 2016 Lincoln MKT Town Car. And the Town Car distinction is because this car is built for the livery industry. It's got bigger brakes, bigger suspension. It's got heavier duty, everything on it. So take the pounding. And I just turned 54,000 miles, and I've had the car about 13 months.
Wow. So how do you know when it's time for a new car?
Every 5 years, whether I want to or not. I usually turn my cars in with 270 to 300,000 miles on them.
Is the money good?
The money's okay. And what people don't realize, too, is that, you get a flat tire. Now you have a client in the car. What do? You have oil changes, gasoline. You have maintenance, brakes, shocks. I mean, it's almost like I want to relate it to an independent operator. Yes, you make X amount of dollars. You can make six figures. You can make $100,000. But making it and then you take out the expenses, you're probably about 40 grand a year, $45,000. So, thank God my wife is retired. She had a great job for 39 years. I'm happy she's retired. She's happy she's retired.
Yeah. Would you say there's a certain personality type that goes into driving? Because, there's a certain personality type in other jobs, and in others you can get all types. What do you think?
Yeah. I think if you want to be in this type of job because you're dealing with people, you're dealing with situations every day, something is different. You have to be someone that can roll with the punches. You have to be someone that can adapt. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to get in a car and I'm going to put it in drive and I'm going to drive 80 miles an hour and I don't care. You have to think about all the time. You have to think about the comfort and safety of your client. Mm. I'll give you a quick story if we have time. I got in one accident in 40 years, and I was on the Merritt Parkway, and I'm driving along, and they have what they call an accordion effect. So as we're driving along, traffic is going and the traffic is stopping. So I hate people that text. It drives me out of my mind. That gives me cause for road rage, because what happened was, as traffic slowed down, this guy was texting and he rear-ended me, and he hit me so hard he bent the tailpipe around the rear tire. So I have an executive in the car. So now my first thought is, what the hell am I going to do? I got to get this guy safely off the road, and the car wouldn't go. So thank goodness for Connecticut State Police. They came. The big orange truck came, protected the cop. I had to change the tire. So actually, they towed me off the highway. But, it's situations like that that you always have to have a contingency plan. I have people that I work with, other independent guys. They're terrific. They're great guys. And I pay them well. So they know that when Larry Elsner calls, I want to work for him.
Right on. Well, we're about out of time.
No,
thank you.
I know. Let's
thank
go.
You. Thank you so much for joining me and telling some stories, Larry Elsner, owner and operator of Solly Co. for 40 years. Thank you for coming in.
And thanks for having me. I had a great time. I want to keep going. Tell the other guy.
All right. After this break, what's it like to be a spiritual leader and an activist? Is there or should there be a difference? You'll find out from Bishop John Selders, co-founder of Moral Monday Connecticut. I'm Kyone Wolf in for Colin McEnroe, who's on vacation. We'll be right back.
King of the road, king of the road, king of the road.
Welcome back. I'm Kyone Wolf in for Colin McEnroe. Today I'm having conversations with three Connecticut residents who have careers in very different fields of expertise. If you're just tuning in, we spoke earlier to Marilyn Nelson, who was the Connecticut State Poet Laureate from 2001 to 2006. Then we talked to Larry Elsner. He was a limo driver for 40 years. And now I'm excited to introduce you to Bishop John Selders. He's an ordained minister serving in the United Church of Christ, the organizing pastor of Amistad United Church of Christ, associate college chaplain at Trinity College in Hartford, and he's the co-founder of Moral Monday Connecticut. Welcome to the show, Bishop.
Glad to be here.
All right, so take me back to the part of your life when you were certain that being a spiritual leader was what you wanted to do. That takes a lot of confidence. So how did that happen? Was it one moment in your life, or was it a series of things?
It wasn't one moment. And the story comes to me. My mother says that I was She was at church carrying me, and I was leaping in her belly when at church with the music. So for me, there was probably never a time I didn't know that ministry was going to be a part of my life. There was nothing I wanted to do more than be a preacher. My grandfather was a preacher. My dad's a preacher. I'm third generation. I have the family business, you know. it's the job I knew I was destined to be. If in some kind of magical way, if you can picture that out a bit, I didn't know I wanted to do anything else.
Yeah. I was raised Catholic, and I don't believe in God anymore, but I tell you, whenever I know that I'm around somebody who is a religious leader, like my posture straightens up, the way I speak sort of tightens up. So I'm wondering how people treat you differently when they find out, if they don't know already, and then they find out through conversation or whatever. How do you get treated differently when people find out?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I have occasion. I don't always wear the collar, so I'm not always identifiable as Reverend. But when I do in particular, I'm always looked at kind of, you know, interestingly. First of all, I get the, well, you don't look like a minister. You don't look like a reverend. You don't look like a father. The hair, you know, whatever. I know what they mean when they say that. So I get these kind of reactions, but invariably people sit down and they start to pour their life out to me. They enter into what I would call casual meeting somebody at a very deep level, on airplanes, on trains, you know, in everyday places. And so for me, I'm kind of given that great honor to have people open up in ways that they feel comfortable in doing so.
Does it ever get to be too much?
No. I think this is how I'm going to speak religiously, because I am a religious person, right? That I get the grace. I'm somehow given the ability to expand and hold in the moments. You know, obviously I go home, I'm going like, whew, that was a rough one today, but like anybody else. But in the moments, the capacity to hold the container of emotion and feeling and discerning, it's always there. It's an ever flowing, never ending reservoir for me.
When you are speaking publicly in front of your congregation, that takes a certain kind of thing, and I don't know what the word is for it. But did that come naturally to you, or did you really have to work at refining your public speaking skills?
And in both, yes, yes, no, yes. No.
Got it. Well, that's our show.
came very naturally. God gave me the gift of gab. So I'm very articulate, you know, at a very young age. And yes, there are skill sets. You have to learn how to do it as well. So kind of end in both. And I'm ever refining. I'm always public speaking. So I'm ever figuring out what works, what doesn't work, what moves a crowd, what moves an individual, what seems to, you know, what's compelling about any story or narrative I'm telling. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for those transition points. When you ask me a question in an interview process, I certainly want to answer your question. I also want to say what I came to say.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, there's that as well.
That's true. What do you think would surprise people about the work you do? It seems like it's easy to understand from the outside, but from the inside, I imagine it's quite different.
It's very hard.
What's hard about it?
I'll say this in any broad sense. Everybody that does whatever they do at a very high level, you think you could throw the basketball and make the shot. You think you can hit that little ball in the hole, and then you get out there on the course and try to do it, and you realize, wow, Tiger Woods has some skills.
Yeah, he had to work at this. This took some practice.
So for me, a lot of times I hear people say, man, you make this look so easy. But then I had to public speak one time, and I was sweaty and all messed up and nervous. So, yeah, people would be surprised to think, you know, this is kind of hard to do.
Do people ever push back? I think talking back to a minister is a pretty bold thing, but do people ever push back on you?
Oh, Yeah, all the time. I get hate mail on a regular. Email and, you know, most often in electronic form. You know, today we can be pretty anonymous, so that happens. But they actually, I like it. When we do an action or we're involved in a thing and it's in the paper and in the comment section, I spend time reading the comments. And
dangerous.
My colleagues, my team says, Bishop, why do you do that? And I'm informed by it. I want to hear what people have to say. I'm informed and I learn. Feedback is good and it's healthy. And I think we all ought to get a little feedback.
I agree completely. Now, earlier in the show when I was previewing this segment with you, I asked, what's it like to be a spiritual leader and an activist? Is there or should there be a difference?
Yes, I would say there are some differences in the way I perceive ministry. I'm not just the pastor of my small congregation. I have a larger understanding or a broader understanding of who I am as a spiritual leader. So, you know, whether that platform is with in my little small community of faith here in Hartford, or I'm at the Capitol getting arrested for singing and praying, which has happened before, or if I'm in Washington, D.C., you know, on the Mall of America, you know, having my Martin Luther King moment, right? Whatever those platforms are, they are an extension of what I believe my call is, what I'm gifted to do, and that's provide some framing, some leadership, maybe some levity, brevity. Maybe I have something to say that might give others some insight, some hope, some inspiration.
Yeah. You, your wife Pamela, and Cornell Lewis are co-founders of Moral Monday Connecticut. Can you describe what Moral Monday Connecticut's all about?
Sure. Moral Monday Connecticut happened because I'm from St. Louis, and in August 9th, 2014, Mike Brown was killed, and I was called to come home. And Pamela and I are both from St. Louis. We went home, and in the course of conversations, it didn't make sense just to be active and involved in the activism and the protests that were happening in St. Louis. I had to come back home to Connecticut, and quite frankly, people said, well, I'm glad, you know, Hartford isn't Ferguson. And the fact of the business is we're one incident away. And so that began a conversation with faith leaders and people of no faith but of conscience. And we connected the Black Lives Matter movement with the broader Moral Monday movement started by Bill Barber, Bishop William Barber, and down in North Carolina, and 3-some years later, here we are.
What kind of things has Moral Monday done?
Oh, we've done a lot of things. We've done lectures and sponsored events. We're known for shutting the traffic down every now and then.
Why do you, a lot of people, when they encounter a traffic stopping protest, they say, get out of the road. This is not the time or place. This is not how you protest. How do you respond to that?
I respond very simply. We made you pay attention for a few minutes, and your inconvenience for the moment may have you think and reflect about the inconvenient lives that are lived by folk. And every action we are involved in has a narrative and has a message. It's pretty clear that when we do that stuff, we also get the opportunity to share that message and hopefully reach and compel people to join the active effort to resist, to struggle, to be in public space, taking on this brand of democracy we founded in this country.
I'm sorry to hear about what's been going on in your hometown of St. Louis. For those who don't know, give us an idea of what's happening right now.
There was an officer that shot an African-American male in 2011. And his trial took place this summer, and he was exonerated. And there's been an active, that happened, the announcement of that case and his exoneration happened on Friday, and there's been civil unrest in St. Louis ever since.
Yeah, that was the shooting of Anthony Lamar Smith in 2011, right? And it's just a few miles away from Ferguson.
Absolutely it was. And it's a tragic, you know, set of circumstances. And what it keeps happening for many of us, it keeps re-traumatizing the experience of a law enforcement officer who doesn't somehow get they get off, and so they don't get the compensation for what some would say an unjustifiable act. You know, if Anthony was selling drugs, as the in this particular case, did it then require his life?
Right, a death sentence.
You know, and officers get to be you know judge and jury, yeah. You know, and executioner in one single act. And there's something wrong, and it smells very funny and fishy in our society that these incidents keep occurring. And we got to figure it out. I often say our society didn't drop out of heaven. we built it. We created it. So, you know, we can recreate it. We can deconstruct and reconstruct in ways that would tend to value everybody, not just one group over another.
What are you hearing from your congregation lately when you're getting up there and speaking? What are you hearing back?
A lot of frustration. People are frustrated. People are sad and saddened that this continues to happen. People are in pain. They are hurting. People are confused. What does it mean that we live in a place, the land of the free, the home of the brave, and it's something seemingly not free, and there seems not to be a lot of courage and bravery for folk to step up and say, listen, we can change this, we can do something different, instead of retreating back into our hunkered down positions that continue to maintain the polarization that we experience in our everyday.
What's next for Moral Monday, Connecticut?
We got stuff going on. October 1st here in Hartford. We're gathering with folk from all over the country, in fact. There was a national call that went out to support a rallying for racial justice. And so we will be leading the effort. We're partnering with a number of different groups from across the state. We'll gather here October 1st. Between 2 and 4 o'clock, the place is to be named, but it's going to be here in Hartford.
Now, you were mentioning that we only have just a couple minutes left. You were saying that we made this, we created this, and so maybe we can have some stake in uncreating it or changing it. What keeps you up at night, and what are you optimistic about?
I do have, you know, sleepless nights. I'm concerned that we're at the brink in some ways of another kind of civil war. And it's been brewing for a while. Race is the unfinished business of our democracy. It's, you know, I would say it in religious terms, it's America's original sin. And we've got to, you know, what Ferguson did do, and it allowed for us to be in a national dialogue about a number of core occurring issues, mass incarceration, education, housing, and racial segregation, all of this and the government's complicity and duplicity in regard to that. They are all in this mix and brew. And what keeps me up at night is trying to figure out how do we reach people? How do we get more people who are activated and engaged? And it's going to take both stuff, the work we do out on the street and the work we do inside houses of power. And so we're engaged in all of that together. That keeps me up at night, Kyle.
Right on. Well, we are out of time. I'm so grateful you could come in, Bishop John Selders. Thank you so much for coming.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for asking.
That was Bishop John Selders of the United Church of Christ and the co-founder of Moral Monday, Connecticut. I'm Kyone Wolf, and for Colin McEnroe, join me again on Friday, September 29th, when we'll be doing a live version of my advice show, What's Your Problem? Three nose panelists will tackle three very different problems, and we're going to try to sort them out philosophically. It should be cool. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan, Katie Talarski, to Marilyn Nelson, Larry Elsner, and Bishop John Selders, and thanks to you for listening.
Say his name, Michael Brown. Say his name, Michael Brown. Say his name, Michael Brown. Won't you say his name? Say his name. 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 Won't you say his name?